This is Kate Magruder. It is January 18th, 2019, recording an oral history for Promise of Paradise, Back to the Land Oral Histories of Mendocino County. Would you introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Nancy Peregrine. I took that name actually when I separated from my past partner. Anyway, I've had many last names and finally I took one for myself. And I moved here in 67, not knowing that there was going to be a Back to the Land movement. I thought I was moving to a wilderness area and it was just me. And so when I ended up buying this piece of land, before I knew it, people around me were buying pieces of land too. And then I realized, oh my goodness, it's a movement. And so that's how that came to be. And it was actually very shortly after I moved here that a woman that I actually knew from Ohio moved here. And so it was this strange synchronicity because she had been going to Antioch College. I had been living in Yellow Springs, Ohio with my husband of the time, and he was going there. And so I knew this woman from the art department there because I used to audit the classes. Since I wasn't a student, I would just audit them and get to learn what I could. So anyway, she showed up a few months, I guess, after I did, and it was astounding that we all ended up here. So I figured there was more at work than just me moving to a wilderness area because more and more people came. And so then it came to be seen as a Back to the Land movement, you know, and so I just realized that I happened to be the first one to live here, but there were a few people that had bought land and they didn't live here yet. A few of them had even started building structures, but then they weren't here. They moved away or whatever. So some of the people that came in the next few years were ended up being very significant people in the community. And since we were an unintentional community and we were so far from the county resources, such as schools, fire departments, all that, we realized we had to do it all ourselves. And so that really brought us together. And it was very bonding for us all because we were from many backgrounds. I would say most of us had come from a somewhat middle-class background. And there wasn't a lot of diversity either, so I can see that. But we really merged into being a very productive community once we started having kids, to have school for them. We had a little daycare in an empty house where the moms took turns being the parent of the day there, and that was preschool. And then Whitethorn School, which is another county, even though it's so close, it's in Humboldt County. As more and more people moved back to the land, so to speak, in adjoining communities, that would be Whitethorn, Edersburg, and other areas around here, that school came to be full. And so then Humboldt County said, well, it's time for your county to take care of its own. And we looked everywhere for a site that the school district in Fort Bragg at the time would approve of, but nothing really worked out. And there was no phone. There's no electricity. Now we do have phone, but we still have no electricity. We're all off the grid. So the first thing we did was we hired a woman through the San Francisco Chronicle to be our teacher. And we had an empty little cabin, and we had fur rounds for the desks and fur rounds for the stools and kerosene lamps because it was a dark little cottage. And I have to say that those kids that had those circumstances, two of them became doctors, one became an engineer, one became an environmental lawyer. They were the most amazing kids, and yet they didn't have a lot of money spent on them, but what they did have was parental interest. And I think that's the most important thing, that their parents were so involved with their education. So, you know, that whole thing of you have to spend more and more money on the kids isn't necessarily so. I think it's if the parents can be involved. Of course, sometimes if they're working, they are limited in how involved they can be. But fortunately, we weren't. Part of my goal of moving to the land was to do everything myself and not have to make money to pay a bill to have somebody else do it. You know, it was a more direct thing. I'm a Sagittarius and I like to just go zip to right to the source. And so I had been living for over a year in Yellow Springs with my husband of the time. And that's where I learned growing gardens organically, canning. We didn't have the ability to freeze anything to preserve. So I just canned everything. I mean, I collected everybody's old jars. I took the lids of canning jars around in my purse with me and would see, is this a canning jar or not? And so I have millions of canning jars, and now I hardly can at all, but I'm afraid to let go of them because I might need them again, you know?
I'm going to pull you back from this wonderful overview of how you got here. Can you tell me when you were born and where you grew up? Let's just start there. I just want to find out. I want to find out what shaped you, Nancy Peregrine.
Well, let's see. I was born in Berkeley in 45, right after World War II. And my father worked for Shell Development Company, and he was a brilliant, brilliant biochemist. He worked on he figured out the molecular structure of penicillin in World War II so that they could mass produce it. And unfortunately, he developed cancer and died at 33 when I was not quite 4. However, I remember him well. He was teaching me the abacus when he died. And it devastated my mom because he had metastasized colon cancer, and she took him home. And he lived many months after that because I can see from when he was diagnosed and when he died. And his friends spoke at his memorial, and they said that he was reviewing a friend's scientific paper on the day he died and on the day that the morphia took him. Well, my mother told me at a later date that the doctor gave her the morphine to give him when he couldn't live anymore, you know. Anyway, that changed our lives quite a bit. And she was a school teacher. She became a school teacher in Alameda. And so there came a time when she wanted to take a year off because she was a writer. And in college, she was the editor of the journalism magazine that they put out at Pomona College down in Southern California. And she wanted to get back into that. And so she opted to take us to a town in Mexico when I was 8, San Miguel de Allende in the state of Guanajuato, which many people know as sort of a tourist town. But back then, it was quite different than it is now in that it only had expats, as they call them, or people from other countries who were attending the art institute there, Instituto Allende, and they had writing there. So she went there primarily to write. Yeah, but her membership allowed family members to join in. And so I got to take any classes I wanted there, which I loved. I would spend half the ceramics class making things on the wheel and the other half writing the bottom of the wheel. I remember going around and around because I was, 8 years old. So I still liked having fun like that. Anyway, and various things that I took at that school. And that was so meaningful to me that she took me to that town because I was the first gringa, the first North American girl to ever go to the girls' public school. And, of course, I didn't speak Spanish when I moved there, but I had to learn very quickly. And the public school was the school where the poorer kids went. So those became my friends, and I'm still in touch with a lot of them. I look them up if I can do a trip back. And the way they educated us was the kids couldn't buy books, so the teacher would actually write the script of a textbook on the bulletin board, and we would memorize it word for word, and we'd stand up one at a time and recite it. And that was partly how I learned. So I can still tell you things that are just etched into my memory because I was so afraid of not doing well that I walked around and around the living room repeating these things to myself, even if I didn't know what the hell they meant, so that I could repeat them when I had to stand up. So I can tell you, las partes del nombre son nominativo, genitivo, dativo, acusativo y ablativo, and whatnot, on and on. Anyway, my mom, she did write, but she was still struggling with the loss of my dad. And she took her life when I was 12. And she did that in Pasadena, where her mother lived, who was in her 80s. And so my grandmother adopted me when she was 82 and I was 12. So you can imagine what a pair we were. She was born in 1876. So she was very liberal politically. And in terms of the morals of the time, she was still back in the 1800s. And here I was in the 60s, a teenager. So we were quite an interesting pair. Anyway, before she died, when she was in her 90s, she decided to give me a little chunk of money, and she gave me $10,000, and I knew that I had to put it into land, and I think that was from my Irish ancestry, that I just knew that if I had land, I could support myself forever. It didn't matter, and the kids. I could grow food. And so at that time, when I graduated from high school, she gave me a trip back to the town in Mexico where I had lived, and I met this man that I ended up marrying, and we decided to hitchhike around the world together. I was all set to go to Cal and Berkeley, and he had been going for a year to Antioch College, and we both decided just to take a break and hitchhike around the world, which we did. And so there are a lot of stories about that, but I know that's not what we're mainly talking about, so I won't go into those. Anyway, it took us a year to hitch around the world, and that was doing everything as cheaply as possible. And he played the guitar. He was quite a good guitarist and singer, and so he would street sing in places, and we could make a little money to pay for things, but we often found where could people stay for free, such as hostels and whatnot, and did that. Met a lot of other people just starting to travel like that, hitchhiking. So it was quite a network of people going both ways, the same way that we were going, and we would become tight friends. Or if people going the other way, they would tell you what you could buy in one country and take to the next to sell for a little bit of money. Anyway, when we got back, I went to college at Cal, but I didn't know what I wanted to study, and so I decided what I really wanted to do was ride down the west coast of Mexico on horseback. And I also decided that I wanted to have a child but not be married, which was a little before it was accepted, and especially for my grandmother. So anyway, I met a man when I was hitchhiking who picked me up, and he had left his family, and he stayed with me in my little cottage in Berkeley, and lo and behold, I ended up pregnant. So I left Cal, didn't tell my grandmother I was pregnant, and went to northern Mexico, bought a horse, and started traveling that way. And I have to say, I started too far north. It was quite deserty, and it was hard traveling. And it was, if it weren't for the native people that lived in little ranches up in the north, I don't think we would have made it. But they often were curious about us and took us in for the night. They fed my horse, and I had a dog with me, and fed me, and then they'd send us off in the morning. But I soon realized that it was difficult terrain, especially. It was desert. And so I ended up selling the horse again and then hitchhiking. And so hitched through Mexico, Belize, Guatemala, and then finally got up the nerve to tell my grandmother I was pregnant. And she said, please come back and have the child with me. So that's what I did. And then that's when I went to live in Ohio with my friend who was going to college there, learned all the skills. Now, they weren't generally acknowledged as skills we should have back then. That is, growing your own food, preserving it, doing everything from scratch, basically. So I don't know where that came from. And there weren't many sources. The only books were Juliet de Berkeley Levy's Herbal Handbook for Farm and Stable, Back to Eden by Jethro Kloss, and The Herbalist by Myers, I think was his name. Those were about it for the herb books. Oh, and Mrs. Grieve, of course. She was back there, too. And then in terms of growing organically, there was Walnut Acres. You could buy bulk organic food. So I bought, and it came in by train, I remember, 100-pound sack of brown rice, 100-pound sack of whole wheat flour, etc., like that. And so
what year was this, do you think, around?
That was 66, yeah. So that's how I started learning to make everything from scratch and to preserve things. I started baking bread daily. There was a piece of property that belonged to Antioch College that let somebody lease a house on the land. There were two houses, and then there was an old chicken coop. Well, the man I was living with had redone the chicken coop to be a little cabin, and that's where we lived. And I could trade making bread daily for the person that was leasing's family in exchange for using their washing machine for diapers, because of course back then it was all cloth diapers. And of course then I'd hang them on the line, and then if it froze they'd be like stiff as boards. Anyway, that's how I did it. So yeah, baking bread daily, and then just observing in the spring anything that was flowering so that you could go back in the fruit setting time and collect all that fruit. So you didn't have to have orchards yourself. You could just find these wild trees everywhere. Choke cherries were big, elderberries were big. There were different kinds of fruit, and I just collected huge quantities and canned them. But I have to say, back then I used a lot of sugar. I didn't know better, really, but and that's partly what preserved things. I learned how to pressure can later, too. So anyway, that's where the original skills came from. And then at Antioch College, we had a friend, Peter Adair, who was in film. And he said, oh, my folks have bought some land in Northern California, and they would like anybody who's interested to help them build their house, and they'll give them a place to camp and money for their food to get by. And so we came out, and some friends did as well, to do that. And when we were out here, we learned that. That was in 67, the winter, fall of 67. That was just here in Whale Gulch. And Whale Gulch, if for people that don't know, is the very northern western corner of Mendocino County. So we're quite distant from the county seat. And this is somewhat of a remote place. It had been logged. It's steep. It had giant old growth firs, not so much redwood, some redwood, but mostly old fir, and it was logged by somebody back in the day without owning it and cutting the trees down, and you can still find a lot of trees they never got out. We met Bob McKee, who's quite the character up here. He had grown up here, and he inherited a farm that had been his great-grandfather's, I believe, and he had bought Whale Gulch for $50 an acre. He had subdivided it. So when I bought this piece, which was 20 acres, I don't know what I was thinking, that I was going to be living forever in a wilderness area, because obviously he was going to sell the other pieces. And so that's how the community came to be. It was all thanks to Bob McKee. But I have to say, Bob, he sold land to a lot of single women with children, and if they were on welfare, he always made the payment so that they could do it on their welfare check, and that's how a lot of women got their land. I was fortunate to have that little pre-death inheritance from my grandmother, so my land was 20 acres. He said at 500 an acre, that would be $10,000, but if I paid cash, it would be 8,500. And I thought, oh, great, then I have 1,500 to build the house. So that's how it all came down. Anyway, Bob McKee was quite instrumental in populating this area, for sometimes to the chagrin of the people in town. I have to say, all these new people coming who were very colorful were sometimes hard for people in town to accept. But there were the people that even bent over backwards to accept people. And so they were wonderful. There was Mamie's little grill, and Mamie ran the grill, but she also helped out people that were moving up here that had any needs. And there were quite a few people, but sometimes it was hard. My husband had a goatee. It was like a well-kept beard. They threw him out of one of the local restaurants for having a beard, along with another guy that had a beard. And that's how it was back in those days. You just never knew how you would be received. And I think it's really interesting for some of those people who are still around today, and myself. I mean, they come to see me for health issues and whatnot. You know, it's like we've all become one. A lot of our kids have married their kids and that kind of thing. So there's been quite a mixture of our two communities. Our community seemed to have, without even talking about it, an understanding of preserving the environment back then. And one of my neighbors who moved here a few years after me, Richard Ginger, who you might know of, it became his life work to keep an eye on Georgia Pacific down the USAW Road, because this was a huge area of redwoods and fir that had nobody scrutinizing it, and they were just taking everything and leaving huge messes, and Richard would report back to us what was going on. I saw some of it because my husband and I got into fishing in Noyo down in Fort Bragg, the harbor at Fort Bragg, and so the closest way down there is to go down this dirt road, 26 mile of dirt road, and so I would see it if they left messes close to the road. But it, at that time, CDF, California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection, which is now called CAL FIRE, but CDF approved timber harvest plans, and they didn't have any provision for if you log 360 degrees around a piece, should you leave that piece in the center to be the seed to regenerate that area? And at that same time, we started an Environmental Protection Information Center called EPIC. And so people were at work that were of a mind bent to be more into the laws, looking at the fact that there was no law to protect pieces that were the last remnants. And so people were working on that. And at the same time, Richard was reporting what was going on down Usal Road. So it came a time that there was one piece left, like a piece of a pie, surrounded by clear cuts and very steep land, Little Sally Bell Grove, we call it. And at that time, too, it became necessary for people submitting timber harvest plans to do a archaeological study to see if these places had been occupied by previous peoples. And interestingly, the one in this grove, they said yes, but it was pre-Sinkione, and therefore it wasn't worth preserving because it was so old. I always thought they had it backwards, because you'd think that the older it is, the more it should be preserved. Anyway, the community here, Well Gulch, mobilized, and we went down and occupied the grove, and the loggers were coming up from Fort Bragg in the dark, like at 4:30 or 5 in the morning, and we were in the grove. And the first time this happened, everybody was shocked that there were people in the grove where they had never seen anybody before. And so we ended up doing a circle in what we called the archaeological site, and nothing really happened that time. But when the lawsuit for the had been submitted for looking at should remnant pieces be preserved, it was submitted in Santa Rosa because it's not a logging community, and Georgia-Pacific had it moved up to Ukiah. Well, there had been a stay on logging until it would be heard, and our lawyers said the stay went with it to Ukiah, and their lawyers said no, it didn't. And so we knew that they would come back in and try to get all the trees on the ground before it could be heard. And so we went back, and that time the law enforcement down south from Fort Bragg area, they were there with all their buses to take us back, and all the people that had been deputized. There were quite a few. I mean, I could say maybe 100 people or more, and some politicians from down south. So they were telling people that were in the grove, if you leave and go out onto the road, that's neutral ground, but if you stay here, you're going to be arrested. Well, three women were arrested pretty early on. And so myself and two friends had gone back out onto the road to discuss the situation, and we decided we wanted to go back in to act in solidarity with the three. So we went back in, but it was a matter of pride for us in a way to get back to the archaeological site, which was a ways into this, and there's cop cars going back and forth. And so for us women that had been living in the woods for years, it was like a point to make that we could evade all of their cars and get back to the archaeological site. And then we just came out in the middle of the road holding hands, walking towards them. And they, of course, their jaws dropped, and they rushed us and threw us on the ground and handcuffed us. And off we went to the Ukiah jail. So in jail, we had phones, which we did not have here. It was a half an hour to the Whitethorn payphone. So in a way, it made it easier to get the word out. So that was our little part, because I have to say, the whole community, the greater community, mobilized at that time. And even the movie theater marquee said, go to Sinkione now. So it became a big thing. So our little part was to write releases for all the newspapers. That's when the Mendocino grapevine was happening way back in the day. And so we wrote things, and we'd call the newspapers and say, would you like a statement from the Sinkione Six? And they would, of course, say yes, because we didn't have money for the phone fees, but they accepted the charges. And then we'd tell them what was going on, because you know how going to jail always makes the news, whereas if you if you don't go to jail, you're not as newsworthy. So that was sort of our point. And I have to say that the other women in the jail who were there for probably minor things like bad checks or things, they were so gracious to us because they could have been not. But they said, would you like some tea? And they had tea bags, and then they just get hot water from the sink there. And they said, you're supposed to have a mattress and a pencil and paper, and you should have access to all these things, because the matron, she actually had a really bad attitude towards us, and she didn't want to give us anything. She wanted us to sleep on the bare cement floor. And I have to say that one of the police officers who was doing our thumbprints as we came in, he told my friend Marie, who has the store, The Hemp Connection, in town now, and who's older than me, actually, he told her, I really support what you're doing, you know. And a lot of people said that, even though, you know, they were in the role of the opposite. But we did a little time in jail, and then we were seen by a judge, and he said, okay, your punishment is to write 10 letters to whomever you want explaining why you did what you did. And his secretary, too, said she supported what we were doing. So, you know, everybody was supporting us in sort of a roundabout way. Anyway, I have to say the end result was that the little Sally Bell Grove still stands. Yeah, so anyway.
What year was that?
That was in the 70s, but I have a huge file from newspapers and whatnot, but I can't remember exactly what year it was. Maybe, could it have been like 73 or something? I don't want to say a year without knowing. yeah. So
I'm going to ask you, when you first came, you and your husband and a daughter, how did you create your shelter? What did you do? Where did you begin in the middle of this wilderness?
Well, when we arrived here, we didn't have a road to the land. We parked over in the meadow, and which that meadow that you drove through was given to this community by Bob McKee as a gathering place, because there aren't many flat areas around here, you may have noticed. And so that became our community gathering space. But then it was as close as we could get to this land without having a road from there to here. So we lived there with my now 2-year-old daughter, and then I was pregnant with my second daughter. And my husband contracted hepatitis A and was basically bedbound, and to hang out in a little potato chip truck converted to a house for a winter was just unfathomable to me. So I would come over here, walk over with an axe, and I cleared this land with an axe. And people have a hard time believing that, but I have to say, it wasn't big old trees. Most of the trees were cascara, which are actually maybe a dozen trunks in one tree up to maybe 12 inches across and smaller. So it wasn't like I was Paul Bunyan or something. You know, I'd hack away at one of those 12 and then go to another and another, and then make big burn piles and burn the brush. Because when I bought this land, I said to Bob McKee, show me the flattest piece of land you have that has gravity water. And I don't know how I knew those things, but I just knew. I mean, it's sort of common sense too, but somehow at the age of 20, I knew that I wanted gravity water to not have to deal with a pump. We didn't have solar pumps then. And that flat was good for growing things, that it made it easier. So anyway, he showed me this piece, and that's when I said, I'll take it. And when he said, well, you can have it for $8,500, not $10,000. And so that's how that happened. So I cleared the land, and then we had the road made. And then my partner Peter and I started finding old falling down barns, and we'd ask owners if there was anybody around to ask, would you like us to take that down? And we'd burn the slash and whatnot too. But we took down a lot of buildings, and then sometimes other people took them down, and we paid a little bit for the wood. That's how we got 10,000 board feet from the dance hall bedrooms upstairs place in Ronerville that had the wood sidewalks. So all those vibes, I think I told you, are in this house too. There was a very nice house, and a more modern house that was at the north end of Redway that some logging had caused flooding to occur above it on the creek. This is above Dean Creek. And so the house got inundated, and the people evacuated it. They sold the wood, and we spent a summer tearing that house apart to get the wood. Those beautiful 3x8 redwood beams over on that side are from that house. I can tell you where every wood is from in this house. Anyway, that same winter that Peter was sick with hepatitis A, we had a pickup truck with a rack, and I just did trip after trip after trip up to Ronerville and bringing the wood back, driving it over here, unloading it by myself because he wasn't available to help. And then we devised a plan. Now, you know, technically you're supposed to get a building permit and you're supposed to get your septic system first, but whoever heard of somebody living in a septic tank? You know, I mean, sometimes I've thought maybe you could make a little house like for homeless people in a tank or a water tank or something, but you don't start with that. You start with an outhouse and then you build something and then you're an outlaw, basically. And so we made a little cabin. It was 16 by 16 with the kitchen sticking out, and it had a loft of a bedroom where we all slept upstairs. And that's where we lived. Now, since then, I added on some to the house because it wasn't a very big house, but we did okay in it. You know, you make do when you're young. You're more resilient, I think. Anyway, I did put in regular plumbing later. I dug the septic tank by hand, salvaged plywood to form up the walls, poured the cement by hand, and all of that. And I learned all of that from this book that I found at our local junk man. We had the most amazing junk man, Burl Keating, who lived in town. Anything you wanted, you just told him what you wanted, and he would find it somewhere. And there were kitchen appliances, books, all kinds of things there. And so anyway, I got this book called How to Build Your Dream House for $3,500 that had the most simple graphs of how to do a septic tank and whatnot. And so I just followed them. And I did my stairs that way too. It was scary to put your square on these long 2x12s and start cutting and wonder if it's going to work out right. But you know what? It worked out right. And it's thanks to the simplicity of this book, which I love.
When you say your junk man was in town, what town are you talking about?
Oh, I'm talking about he was in Garberville. Yeah, Garberville and Redway are two adjacent towns, so we just call them town. Yeah. So back in those days, we didn't have any phones. And when we were fishing out of Noyo, a young boy, had given me some pigeons that had come into his pigeon loft because he had too many. Some wild ones had followed his own back in. He would release them, and then they have these little one-way doors, and his would come back in and the wild ones would come in with them. So he gave me a bunch of his pigeons, which I just had for fun, really, but I had chickens and a chicken coop. Well, I found that you could still buy little capsules to put on the pigeons' legs. And when people would be here and then they were going towards Whitethorn where the first phone was, I'd say, could you make a phone call for me and then write the answer to whatever it is I'm trying to find out on this little piece of paper and put it in this and let the pigeon go. And they would come back to the to the chicken coop. Sometimes they didn't make it that night, and I guess they stopped somewhere in transit, and then the next morning they would come in. And yeah, so that's how I first did communications. Then I got more high tech, and I became a ham radio operator because I found out that on the ham radio base station, which is up on Pratt Mountain, which is east of Garberville, there's a function called an auto patch, and you can actually just punch a few numbers and get into the phone lines. And so for emergency situations, that seemed like a wise thing to have, that you could call 911 or whatever. So anyway, I've been a ham since those days, and that was a long time ago, so I'm still a member of the local ham club. And we do it pretty much for emergency communications, to be able to jump in and help with that if the need be, you know, if the phones all go down. So we've got a nice little group in this area. We check in every Monday night at 7 on what we call the net, and make sure that's just to make sure our equipment is working, basically. Yeah, so I still have that function.
When your children were beginning to get to be school age, what did you do about school for them?
Well, at first they went to White Thorn School in Humboldt County, and we had a great teacher there and a great group of kids, and so that was wonderful. But eventually, when there got to be more and more back-to-the-land kids, Humboldt County said, it's time for your county to take care of its own. I'm going to cough. And so we tried working with Fort Bragg Unified School District to find a site to put a school, but really nothing panned out, neither site-wise nor in terms of the fact that we didn't have power nor phones. They didn't really want such a independent school. So we hired our own teacher, put an ad in the San Francisco Chronicle. She was a poet. I don't know what we were thinking, but she's the one that came up, and she was great, really. And she had that first group of kids, the older kids, and that was the group that ended up having two people that became doctors. One became an environmental lawyer, and one became an engineer. So what are you going to say? You know, I mean, these are the kids that had the rounds of fur for their desks and seats and the kerosene lamps for their light. Anyway, then we decided to put up our own school, and we bought a canvas yurt for the first school, and we waterproofed it and this and that. Well, it didn't work out that well. We built a platform all together. We all pounded the nails. We actually milled the wood, pounded the nails, made this big platform, put up a canvas yurt. But every time it rained with wind, the canvas roof would slap on the beams, and it would force the water through. And so anytime it was going to rain and everybody's leaving the school for the night or the weekend, everything had to be covered with plastic inside. Oh my God, that was a lot of work. But we have some great pictures and great memories of those times of the year when it was beautiful weather. The kids had a wonderful time there. It was so light inside. It was wonderful. So then we decided, okay, we have to build a wooden school. So that's what we did. We ended up building part of it and then another part later. And now we have K through 12. And we are part of the Leggett Unified School District. And so we have teacher salaries and aide salaries. And we have the person that does all the maintenance. And it's great. It's a great school. In fact, a lot of the Humboldt County kids choose to come to our school because there's smaller classes and more individual attention and just wonderful people. It's like a family, really.
What's the name of that school?
It's Whale Gulch School. Yeah, I taught at it for many years. I taught Spanish primarily because having lived in Mexico, I was a Spanish speaker, but also I knew how to do the grammar of Spanish, so I could explain that and whatnot. So did K through 12 Spanish for many years and also helped with general math and things like that. So it's, you know, I was part of the evolution of that school. Now I'm not really so connected with it, and I sort of miss that because I loved being connected with the kids, really, knowing them. Now I don't know them all, and it's different. Yeah.
Can you tell me, I know that you were talking to Laura about this earlier, but can you tell me about your evolution as a health practitioner and your choice to go down and do more schooling?
Oh, yeah. Well, I've always had an interest in the plants here. You know how some people only look at birds and some only look at the trees? And I was the one always looking at the ground and the little plants. And I have to say that I didn't even realize it when I bought this land. This land is a pharmacy. Oh, my God. This land has medicinal plants everywhere on it. And I was learning them one by one without help of anybody to teach me. I would look at pictures in books or ask people. It took forever to figure each plant out. Finally, I made a nice list because then I started doing native plant, medicinal plant walks with Sanctuary Forest, which is a nonprofit group that's been working for years on keeping the fish coming into the Mattole River. And so they do these free hikes. So one of them was my native plant hike. anyway, I started learning about the different plants. And to tell you the truth, I didn't get sick much myself, but if my kids or my partner did, I would experiment on them. And I have some funny stories about learning what these plants do. For example, my ex-husband, he had a chest cold, a cough and whatnot, and it was sort of deep and a little worrisome. And I had heard about mustard plasters, but I wasn't sure how you did it. But I had some powdered mustard, and so I mixed that with water and smeared it on his chest and then put a towel or something over. Well, it made him have blisters because you're supposed to mix the flour of the mustard with wheat flour or some kind of other flour, you know, and sort of thin it out. Anyway, that was my beginning learning. But then as there came to be more and more people interested in herbs, I went to a lot of programs put on by the California School of Herbal Studies, Rosemary Gladstar, and went on a trip to Greece to visit Juliet de Berkeley Levy, who was my hero, my Shira, because she wrote that first book that I used called Herbal Handbook for Farm and Stable, which is amazing. She lived with nomadic people and gypsies all over the place, mainly in Europe, and learned from them and wrote about that in her book. So it's quite an interesting book. Anyway, she's passed away now. So I was just learning wherever I could. But then once I was divorced and wanting to figure out some ways to make a living besides the school, I decided, okay, I'll do several things. I'll go back to school. And I saw an ad for a holistic nutrition program in Santa Rosa. It was a 2-year program to become a certified holistic nutritionist. And I did that on weekends, driving down for the program. But I also, for 10 years, did wilderness trips with groups that would come up mainly from the Bay Area with my 6-pack llamas and took them out into the King Range and down into the Sinquion Wilderness State Park for 3 or 4 days. I knew that I wanted to do something with large animals that could pack, but I knew that hoofed animals were not the way to go because, for one thing, they're dangerous for people that aren't used to working around hoofed animals. So I realized that llamas were the way to go. And I had met a couple who did llama pack trips. They were the first in the U.S., and I think I was the second. They were from El Dorado County, but they came over to do a trip in the King Range. And so I signed up with them and said, I want to learn how to do what you're doing. And so we became friends back then. And then one by one, I acquired 6-pack llamas. They were always the males, the females. People kept them barefoot and pregnant, basically. So I had 6-pack llamas and groups of up to 12 people with me. And usually I'd take a helper, too, because actually I cooked all the meals and it was a lot of work, really. So somebody would get to come for free in exchange for helping me out. And I did that for 10 years. And I built some boarding stables so that people that had large animals had a place to bring them if they were going away or if they didn't have a place on their own land where they could keep them. So quite a few people had horses and ponies, milk goats. Somebody brought some buffalo to board because he bought them without knowing he was going to buy them. And so he asked if he could board them. Anyway, various animals. So I enjoyed that because I love animals. And I'd keep people's milk animals going as they were away. I'd milk them daily so that when they came back, they'd still have milk and whatnot.